Tonight on KPFT Local News at 5:30 p.m.
Experience before is we don't routinely weigh and measure all the kids, which in pediatrics is a problem because this is a kind of an intermittent thing. There aren't records kept of all the findings. That can't really do growth monitoring, can't review their immunization status. It's not what you'd like for a primary care system. It's certainly better than nothing, but you should buy them all the restrictions on movement, and this is kind of the best that can be done. It's not unlike taking care of homeless kids in some place like New York, where people might pop up in one place and then in another and then in another, and there are attempts to address that by using computerized records. There's nothing like that available here. If we found a child who was not immunized here today, we wouldn't be able to administer vaccines. I don't think we're traveling with vaccines.
These stories and more from 90.1 FM, Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston. News in a global context from your community, city, state, and region. With your hosts, Tanya Akpabio and Nadia Michelle. This is KPFT Local News at 5:30 p.m.
Good evening and welcome to KPFT Local News at 5:30 p.m. It's Tuesday, December 27th. I'm KPFT News Co-Director Renee Feltz. Tonight, we bring you part two of a special series titled Israel and Palestine, the Human Cost of the Occupation. This week, during the local news time slot, you'll hear the series. It's produced by Pacifica reporter and medical student Seema Jalani. Seema is also a Houston-based reporter with KPFT Local News.
Rarely have two peoples been so similar to each other. I went to Israel and to Palestine in March of 2005 with a group called the Jewish American Medical Project, which is a division of Visions of Peace and Justice with Israel and Palestine. Our delegation consisted of four physicians, a child psychologist, two environmental researchers, an educator, an attorney, and myself as a representative of American medical students and also a media contact for Pacifica Radio. Our goal was not only to provide health care to those in need while working in conjunction with Physicians for Human Rights Israel and the United Palestinian Medical Relief Committees, but also to document the effects of the occupation on both the Israeli and the Palestinian societies and bring those stories back to the United States in an effort to better educate the public here. Dr. Alice Rothschild, co-founder of Visions of Peace and Justice with Israel and Palestine and an obstetrician-gynecologist at Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, most recently has focused on peace and justice concerns in Israel and Palestine. Throughout this piece, Dr. Rothschild shares her reflections as she experiences the terrain from a Jewish-American perspective, while I, on the other hand, experienced it as a Muslim-American. Dr. Rothschild reflects on her experiences so far.
The only Jews that I'm seeing, besides my group, are young soldiers. And I've been looking at the faces of the soldiers. First of all, because I'm basically afraid of people who carry huge automatic weapons, and there are a lot of those people wandering about. For instance, when we were going through a checkpoint this morning, you feel like you're a piece of cattle, right? And there's a chute for young men. And I was in the chute for women, people over 50, children, and doctors. You're in this flood of people who are trying to squeeze into one person line. And there are two soldiers there, probably in their 20s. There was a woman and a man. The woman's face was almost blank. She did not establish eye contact. She was gruff. She yelled a lot. And there were a flood of little school children. They must have been 5 years old, 6 years old, cute little kids, you know, hair and little ponytails. And they each had backpacks, and she yelled at each one and made them stop and opened their backpacks and felt inside. And I looked at the faces of these children who look at her like she has so much power over them. And if one of them got ahead, she would make them come back. But there was a brutality in her face that was very, very frightening. And I keep thinking, she's thinking, which one of these kids has the bomb, has the suicide bomb? And I look at these children. These are innocent children. I almost started crying. But I was too scared to cry at the moment. And then next to her was a slightly older, a male soldier, who was smiling. He was much more friendly. As Palestinians have various permits and papers that make it possible for them to go wherever they go. And if you don't have the right papers or permits, you can't go somewhere. Dr. Majid, he's one of the deans of Al-Quds Medical School. He has three things. He has an ID card, he has a magnetic card, and he has a special permit. In order to get to East Jerusalem to the medical school, he has to have these other special permits. So here is this very lovely, dignified man with his briefcase in his suit, looking very professional, standing online, and he has to do this every time he wants to go from his home to his work and from his work to his home. Well, what he said to us was, I'll pick you up at the hotel at 7. I thought he would come in a car and pick us up. When we get there, there's no car. And he says, well, I can't drive to East Jerusalem because he has the wrong colored card. So we had to take a cab to a checkpoint, go through this line, take another cab to get to the hospital. It was very clear to me that he needed to maintain his sense of dignity and professionalism in the face of what was really a humiliating situation. This is how life is. Both Israelis and Palestinians are used to a situation that doesn't feel normal to someone who comes in from the outside. We had a cab driver who drove us to Augusta Victoria Hospital today. He had to go through a special checkpoint where you have to have a permit not only for yourself but for your cab. So the soldier took his papers and we sat and waited. And I was watching the face of the cab driver. And at first he had that sort of look of cab driver resignation. And then he started to look really annoyed. And then he and Dr. Majid started talking away in Arabic very animatedly. And we waited some more and we waited some more. And we were wondering what was going on. And finally the cab driver couldn't stand it anymore. And he got out of the cab and he walked over to the place where the soldiers sit. Stormed back with his permit, and I asked Dr. Majid what happened, and he said that when he went over to the soldiers just looked up and said, oh, we were just bringing you your permit, when clearly they weren't just bringing the permit. They were just making him wait. This happens to this man hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times a year. That really is very detrimental to someone's spirit and someone's hope. Ultimately, that's not in Israel's interests to be making more Palestinians more angry. I am not having any interactions with any Jewish Israelis that are being nice to me. And I wonder what it would be like to grow up and never meet a Jewish Israeli who had a decent thing to say to you. It may be that when you're in it all the time, it's less acute because it's the background noise. It's how you get to work. It's the hassle. Except that it has that added dimension of unpredictability, the threat of being beaten up. And we passed some settlements, and you could see the red roofs on the hilltop, a classic settlement look. And then these little, like, trailers that were sort of leaking down the hill as the more radical elements of the settlement tried to capture a couple of more meters of ground. And you think, what does this look like to a Palestinian who doesn't really believe anything that the Israeli government says in the first place? And there it is, right in front of your face. If there's not a wall, there's a settlement, or there's a big concrete block with a young man with a big gun deciding whether you go through or not. It's a pretty outrageous situation.
Dr. Rothschild brings up the point of suicide bombings. It would be remiss of me not to mention the effect of suicide bombings in Israel and the general reaction to them from Israelis. Violence from years past fueled the events from 1987 to 1993, when the world saw its first glimpse of a Palestinian popular uprising, translated in Arabic as the Intifada, which literally means the shaking off. The first Intifada is largely seen as a grassroots movement that began as nonviolent resistance to the Israeli occupation of Palestine. For the first few years, it involved many forms of civil disobedience, including massive demonstrations, general strikes, refusal to pay taxes, boycotts of Israeli products, political graffiti, and the establishment of underground schools, since regular schools were closed by the military as reprisals for the uprising. By the end of the First Intifada, both sides were turning to more and more violent methods. The First Intifada resulted in the deaths of 1,162 Palestinians, including over 200 under the age of 16 and 160 Israelis. Thursday, September 28, 2000, saw the start of the Second Palestinian Intifada. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's visit to the grounds of Al-Aqsa Mosque, a sacred and holy site to Muslims, on a background of numerous failed attempts at peace, ignited the cycle of violence known today as the Second Intifada. 2 days after Sharon's mocking visit to the mosque, 12-year-old Muhammad Dura was killed by Israeli troops. His death, in the arms of his father while they hid behind a garbage can, caught the international community's attention when it was televised around the world. This second intifada did not prove to be as peaceful as the first. A string of suicide bombings in Israel from late 2002 through 2004 instigated more violent clashes on both sides. According to the Amnesty International 2004 report on Israel and the occupied territories, around 600 Palestinians, most of them unarmed and including more than 100 children, were killed by the Israeli army in random and reckless shooting, shelling, and bombings, or as a result of excessive use of force. At least 130 Israeli civilians, including 21 children, were killed by Palestinian armed groups. Almost half of the victims were killed in suicide bombings, and the others were killed in shooting attacks. The Israelis, rightfully so, have a great fear of suicide bombings, and it is for this reason that I notice that they are even more liberal than the American Jewish population with regards to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. If you listened carefully to the segment before, Ronnie Jaeger of Maxim Watch was complaining that her Israeli tax money was being used to fund a military occupation and guard the settlers in the occupied territories. Israelis have seen a significant lack of social services and benefits as a result of the occupation. Because the Israelis have to live with the consequences of the occupation, whether it be in the form of suicide bombings or in the form of less social services available to their citizens, the Israelis I met with, no matter how patriotic, wanted the settlements in the occupied territories to be dismantled. Writer and representative for Gush Shalom, a Jewish peace group based in Tel Aviv, Adam Keller comments on suicide bombings.
The general public has come to the conclusion that we have exhausted our military options. And I think also the Palestinians have come to the conclusion that they have also exhausted the effectiveness of their military options. I mean, the suicide bombings are, leaving morality aside, are a very effective way of terrorizing the Israeli population, creating real feeling of fear. I know it from my personal experience, because suicide bombers don't know what is your opinion, political opinion. We stand just as much chance as anybody else to be in exactly the bus which is blown up. In 2002, one of our members was killed in a suicide bombing in Haifa. And a little bit earlier, there was a time when a suicide bomber blew himself up in Tel Aviv, in a place where my mother had been less than 10 minutes before, and it took me about 4 hours to find out that she is okay, because the whole telephone system of the Tel Aviv area collapsed. It is a way of hurting the Israeli society, of terrorizing the Israeli society, also quite effective way of damaging the Israeli economy, but at the price which I think in quite a lot of Palestinians think, a prohibitive price of behaving in a very brutal and immoral way, and of very much damaging the Palestinian cause and making Palestinians perceived as terrorists and murderers. And most of the Palestinian factions are quite unanimous in feeling that this has to stop. This suicide bombing which happened 2 weeks ago in Tel Aviv was very much condemned in a very sincere way, not only by Abu Mazen, but the ones who did it, the Islamic Jihad, were very clearly divided among themselves, and it was done by the faction which is based in Syria, quite against the wish of the faction which is based in the occupied territories themselves.
I asked two members of our Jewish delegation to comment on what the creation of Israel meant to them as Jewish people and how they view suicide bombings. Freelance writer and Jewish activist Stephanie Seamus responds.
I was just 12 when Israel was created as a country and when statehood was granted, and I can remember my grandfather listening on the radio to the vote from the UN. He had been a devoted Zionist all of his life, but I can remember his taking me after this into his study and saying, "This is a very important day. I want you to know, I want you to remember what an important day is. We have a country. We have Israel. There were tears in his eyes. That was sort of the most emotional I had seen him. Even as a 12-year-old, you know, I knew something important had happened. You know, when I graduated from college, and it was, at that time, an extremely idealistic and energetic and wonderful country. Now, when I look back on it, I'm sort of horrified to think that nobody talked about Palestinians. There were sort of these Arabs, you know, who were somewhere, you know, but not in anyone's range of vision. I realized how much I didn't see at the time. I nonetheless really fell in love with the country and with the land itself. I made several trips back. Over the course of these many visits, I began to kind of see for myself some of what was not publicly talked about. I also was very distressed to see that the Jews, particularly American Jews, the Orthodox, had really taken over Jerusalem. It was just not the city that I remembered it as. I lost a son to cancer, so I know what it's like to lose a child. And I guess that's why I say it's a tragedy. Ultimately, you know, I could find all kinds of ways to say, look, suicide bombers act out of desperation. You know, they don't have an army, could justify that. Somebody taking the other side could justify the response to the suicide bombings, etc. It doesn't matter. What it comes down to is that there are mothers and fathers who have lost children. There are people who are suffering terrible, terrible loss. It's just horrible. My son died of cancer. I had no control over that. For somebody to lose a child is something that didn't have to happen. It's just horrible.
I asked Ms. Seamus to tell me the most memorable experience of the entire trip for her.
The first checkpoint we went through, I was so shaken. I mean, I knew what checkpoints were. I had seen pictures. I had read about them. But there was something about standing in those concrete barriers with the barbed wire and the trenches and the soldiers with guns. And I just went, you know, I remember getting through to the other side and just shaking. I was literally shaking. I was just so enraged. I just wanted to say, I just wanted to go back and say, stop it, you can't do this.
Dr. Alice Rothschild shares her personal story and her views on suicide bombings.
I started out in a very traditional way with a Jewish upbringing, Hebrew school three times a week, you know, the prerequisite trip to Israel when I was 14, and grew up in the shadow of the Holocaust. And then when I got older and got to college and medical school, this led me to reopen the whole question of creation of the State of Israel, to delve deeper into other narratives and other versions of that history, partly because I began to feel very uncomfortable with a state that claimed it was doing something in my own name as a Jew, and I felt that as a Jew and as a U.S. citizen that I also had an obligation to look at what was going on in Israel and in Palestine. You know, when I went to Israel, this was this tremendously positive trip to this miraculous country. There was no mention of Palestinians. Even though I have a fairly progressive family, we were actually brought up in a fairly racist manner when it came to Arabs. It was just this love affair. There was no critical analysis of history or anything. I mean, I was only 14, but also, you know, I spent my childhood, you know, putting quarters in the little blue box, and, you know, whenever there was a holiday, we bought trees in Israel. And, you know, we were part of that generation and that scene, and so that's the part of Israel that I got to see. I am horrified by suicide bombing. I think it's unconscionable. I think it's destructive to any movement towards creating a peaceful resolution of anything. I also understand that it comes from many different places, that there are people who do want to destroy the State of Israel, but they're also, if you have a situation where people have no hope and people have no jobs and people have been repeatedly traumatized at checkpoints and people's fathers have been political prisoners and have been tortured and all the things that go on, that this is like a garden for suicide bombers. And I also think that just as I am appalled and horrified by suicide bombers, I'm also appalled and horrified by what I would call state terrorism, which would be home demolitions, targeted assassinations, separation wall, all the ways that people are violated. So it's not that they're, you know, that the Palestinians have their terrorists and the Jews don't. The Jews do. And they also have very fundamentalist right-wing settlers who behave a lot like Hamas, who walk around with machine guns and shoot Palestinians in olive groves and, you know, are just as abhorrent to me. There's a lot of violence going around here, and I really feel that none of it is productive. You know, every time I hear someone say, you know, Palestinian mothers don't love their children, I just want to, like, start screaming. And, you know, that kind of mythology is very destructive, and it's completely untrue. And I wonder, you know, when Jewish settler women take their 12 children and live in some, you know, dangerous little settlement in the middle of the West Bank and have to have a military convoy to go anywhere, and their children are endangered every day, does anyone say those Jewish women don't love their children because they choose to live in a dangerous place, whereas the Palestinian women are living where their mothers lived and their grandmothers lived, and it's dangerous? I mean, there's all these double standards.
In 2002, the British Medical Journal published a report showing that the Israeli blockade of Gaza has produced a health crisis among Palestinians. According to the World Food Program, as of mid-2004, approximately 1.3 million people in the occupied territories, or 38% of the population, were food insecure. Food is generally available in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank, but access to food is limited for physical reasons, such as curfews and closures. Researchers have also found that both in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank, more than half the children were getting less than the acceptable intake of calories, and that half of them did not get enough vitamin A or folate. The Jewish American Medical Project participated in medical care both in Israel and in Palestine. Dr. Alan Myers, a pediatrician from the Boston Medical Center, explains the limitations of a mobile clinic.
The problems that I've experienced before is we don't routinely weigh and measure all the kids, which in pediatrics is a problem. Because this is a kind of an intermittent thing, there aren't records kept of all the findings. That can't really do growth monitoring, can't review their immunization status. It's not what you'd like for a primary care system. It's certainly better than nothing, but limited by all of the restrictions on movement, and this is kind of the best that can be done. It's not unlike taking care of homeless kids in some place like New York, where people might pop up in one place and then in another and then in another, and there are attempts to address that by using computerized records. There's nothing like that available here. If we found a child who was not immunized here today, we wouldn't be able to administer vaccines. I don't think we're traveling with vaccines. We have a limited pharmacy. You know, whatever medication we decide, these kids are only going to get what they have on hand, or a prescription to find it somewhere else, and that means spending money.
I'm reporting from the Bidia Mobile Clinic, sponsored by Physicians for Human Rights, sponsored by United Palestinian Medical Relief Society. There are about 60 people waiting in line for health care, either general checkups or children that are sick. There are also several doctors here, one internal medicine, one pediatrician, one medical student, and other people to help out. I see people in white jackets that are part of the Palestinian Medical Relief Society here in the mobile clinic in Bidia. We had to pass through one checkpoint, the Nablus checkpoint, at which there were approximately 50 people standing and waiting in line, one with a sick child that was crying. At the end of the line, everyone was made to wait for about 30 minutes. In addition, there was the heaviest security in Nablus that I had ever seen, with pointed loaded artillery and pointed loaded AK-47 in the Nablus area right outside the checkpoint. One of the difficulties we're finding here is pediatric medications are generally prescribed by kilogram, depending on the child's weight, and there's only one scale here at the clinic. So the difficulty is trying to get that scale, get the children's weight, distribute it evenly amongst the other patients, and simply lack of supplies again. And so right now we're just trying to locate a scale in the clinic. Earlier we saw a child that needed to be referred to on the Kauffman Hospital for a CT scan and for some physical therapy and occupational therapy. And now we're right now discussing some of the intricacies of what will be going on in order to make that happen. We'll have to get some special permits for the child to be able to get from Ramallah or from Nablus into East Jerusalem to be able to go to Al-Makasa Hospital, the main hospital that supplies diagnostic techniques like CT scans, etc. But it does require some additional permits.
You've been listening listening to a documentary produced by Seema Jalani and co-edited by Dr. Alice Rothschild. This is part two of a special series titled Israel and Palestine, The Human Cost of the Occupation. This week, during the local news time slot, you'll hear the five-part series. To hear previous parts of the series, look for the corresponding KPFT news shows from this week when you visit the KPFT audio archives online at archive.kpft.org. I'm KPFT Local News co-director Renee Feltz.
This has been a production of KPFT Local News at 5:30 p.m. News in a global context from your community, city, state, and region. You can hear KPFT Local News every weekday at 5:30 p.m. For comments or story tips, contact KPFT Local News. Our email address is news@kpft.org. To reach the newsroom by phone, call 713-526-4000. Extension 309. This is 90.1 FM Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston. I'm Philip Jackson.